Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that doesn't charge extra for private servers. I'm back from paternity leave, and I've played a whole lot of video games, including the fantastic Disco Elysium and the great new RPG Outer Worlds. Maddie is still playing Fire Emblem, and we've got a lot of news to talk about, including BlizzCon predictions, Ubisoft delays, and Fallout 76 getting a premium subscription. We close things off by talking Mindhunter, the anime, Carol and Tuesday, and El Camino, the new movie from the makers of Breaking Bad. All right, here we go. And we are back for another episode. My name is Jason Schreier, returned at long last to another episode of the show. And I am here once again with Maddie Myers.
Yes, you are. I'm here.
And Kirk Hamilton.
You sure are. It's nice to see your smiling face, Jason Schreier.
Yay! Hello, hello, hello. I come to you completely bleary-eyed and exhausted, having not only just had a child, but also been going through the work drama to end all work dramas, as some of you out there might have heard. Real quick up top, we won't get into all of that stuff, but as always, we should reassure people that no matter what, the three of us will find a way to keep podcasting. So if you hear about some sort of catastrophe at our company, just keep an eye on our Twitter feeds or this podcast feed, or just keep an eye out. If suddenly this podcast feed stops updating, just keep an eye out for us elsewhere. I'll put it that way. Is that fair to say?
Is that a good way? The show is not going to stop updating somewhere.
Right. So. The show will be updating somewhere.
If you are hankering for hearing me and Maddie and Jason talk about video games, you will still get to hear that one way or another.
You will still get to hear that. Guys, having a child is a real trip.
I've heard that that's the case. Tell me more.
I don't even know how to sum up like the past 5 weeks in just a couple of minutes, mostly because I don't know, all the days have kind of blurred together for me, so I've just lost track of like what happened, what. I just don't remember anything anymore.
Like, you could try just like let an exhausted scream out for about 30 seconds and see if that sums it up.
But it's pretty amazing. Now back at the office for the first time since the birth of my kid, and I keep texting my wife and telling her to send pictures of the kid to me, so I'm at that point where I've been I haven't been this long, this much time away from her. So I've grown attached to the little creature. The little creature who doesn't do anything except like poop and cry and eat and sleep.
That's it. Yeah, that's all they do for a little bit.
But at least she cuddles. That's all. Right. That's all you really need. Cuddling with a baby, while as I texted you a few weeks ago for episode 200, cuddling with a baby on your lap while playing video games is pretty great. So I gotta say,
it's a great pursuit. One thing I could do is print out a picture of her and put it over my face while we podcast, and then you would be looking at her as we do this show.
That would definitely work.
The listeners would not quite get that experience.
No, that's true. Maybe that would be for the best.
And yeah, I actually had a lot of time to play video games, so I wound up playing just like a ton of different video games, just like spending a bunch of different hours in different video games, because babies, especially newborn babies, just want to be held all the time, and they get fussy and mad when they're not being held. So I wound up just holding her while playing games on my computer, which was pretty cool. Why don't we get right into it and talk about some of those video games? I can start off by talking about some of the games that I've been playing. So, real quick, just to give you guys like a brief sampling of all of the games that I've been jumping into, and Kirk, you've heard some of these because I was texting you a little bit, but I played some Dishonored 2 good video game. I played a bunch of Dark Souls 3, another good video game. I played a bunch of Pillars of Eternity 2, which is an RPG that I bounced off last year because of Divinity Original Sin 2, and because that game is so just like groundbreaking that it kind of ruined Pillars for me. But what they did was add a turn-based mode that I think makes the game better and does some really interesting stuff. And so that was pretty fun. I've played a bunch of The Witcher 3, which is what I'm actually currently playing, much to Kirk's delight. Because I just like on a whim decided to start replaying it on PC, and it just looks so good that
Were you shocked to discover that it is still one of the best video games ever?
I was not shocked to
it was not a surprising revelation.
Awesome. Just a good ass video game. But speaking of some of the best video games ever, I want to talk about a game that came out of nowhere and shocked me, and I had never heard of it until I started playing it, and then it just blew my mind and it's become one of my games of the year. Disco Elysium. And I know you guys talked about this a little bit the other day.
Kind of quite a bit. I mean, I think listeners do know what it is.
But it's fine. Let's do it again.
But I want to hear your take on it. But you can trust that listeners have a pretty good sense of what it is. I've explained it several times on the show.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I also finished the game. I know you haven't finished it yet. Ooh. So I have kind of the full context of the whole thing. I did it in 26 hours, which is I think most people will take longer. I'm a pretty fast reader. What a friggin' game. So yeah, just a quick abridged summary is that it's basically Planescape Torment meets a LucasArts adventure game. It's like an RPG where everything takes place over dialogue. It's almost visual novel-y in that sense, but it's also all about choice and consequence, and a lot of the decisions that you make wind up having all these far-reaching effects. You play as this detective cop who has to investigate a murder and figure out who did it. And he also has voices talking to him. He's kind of a mess of a cop, like the best noir cops are. And all these different voices are actually personality traits. So like in an RPG, how you would choose from all these different perks and stuff, like charm and empathy and suggestion and stuff like that. These are all actually voices in your character's head. So you see them all talk every single time you're in dialogue, which is really, really cool and really, really interesting. Kirk, I should ask, how far are you in the game?
I just finished the first full day, so I made quite a bit of progress and have played a lot more since even the last time, Maddie, I talked to you about the game, and have an even better sense of it, and it continues to surprise and delight me. I can talk more about my take on it, I think, in a minute, or we could just talk about it now, I guess.
Yeah,
but I want to hear more
of what
you thought of it.
Give me an example of something that surprised and delighted you, and I can talk about like my own different experiences, because we probably had drastically different experiences with each other.
Yeah, so I gather you're playing a character who focuses on psyche. So there are these four kind of attributes you can pick as your main attribute. There's your kind of physical composition, which is your strength and kind of other physical things. There's psyche, which is like your empathy and your inner world, and there's intellect, and then there's one other it's like your kind of dexterity and poise and composure. And I focused on intellect, and I think you focused on psyche, which is already, even just in things I've been asking you about, there are things that are happening to me that didn't happen to you. I get the sense you could play this game three or four times and have very, very different experiences. Yep. Like the first time through is probably just, you know, only the scraping the surface. A thing that surprised and delighted me, let's see. One thing that happened recently was the experience of reading a book in this game. So, yeah, I compared it last week to Inside Out, the Pixar movie, and it still kind of reminds me of that. This feeling of you have these rogue, or at times rogue, like agents in your head that are your personality traits, and they don't always have the right answers. They're very self-interested and monomaniacal, because they're like, whatever, I'm just your one thing. Like, I'm your authority, your sense of authority, and I think you should just impose your authority on everybody all the time. And you're like, maybe I'm not going to listen to you right now. So I was reading a book, and it was about the history of this world, which is fascinating, this sort of, you know, how this government came to be and the history of the sort of religious order behind it. And as I read the book, I have a really high encyclopedia skill, which means that my guy knows a lot of trivia. And my encyclopedia skill kept piping up and saying that it knew things. It's like, oh, I know what that is. And it would just tell me but it would always be some random fact that I didn't really need to know. And my character would
always...
And you
can, like, decide if you want to be a pedant or not and, like, interrupt a conversation by being
100%. You can actually do that. There are times where you're talking to someone and your encyclopedia will pipe up and be like, actually, what he really means is this. And you can say that, or you can be like, that is not important. important. I do not need to point that out to him right now. And, mm-hmm. you know, different things will happen based on what you do. This was just an interaction with a book. So what's cool is you also have dialogues with inanimate objects or memories. There's a photo of the corpse, you know, the person you're investigating, and you talk with it. And if you have a high enough certain trait, you can ask it, who are you? And you'll have some instinct. And it's like you're having a dialogue with a photo. Really cool. And I was having this thing with the book, and during the conversation at the end, it gives me a quiz. And it's a quiz of things I can't possibly know because I haven't been, I don't actually live in this world, and my character's an amnesiac. But the thing is like, okay, so who is this person? And it asks this name. And my encyclopedia is like, oh, I know this. It's this. And they tell me the name. And I'm like, okay, and I guess that. And it's wrong. And it's because my, like, I think I know a thing, and it's telling me I know the thing, but I don't know the thing. So Maddie, we talked about this some last week.
Yeah,
this question
and I was like,
of
are
like,
you ever wrong?
Exactly. So I definitely was wrong.
That's
and
awesome.
That conversation wound up just being really funny, and I guessed some things right and was really just kind of guessing, and it wound up being this really interesting thing. And I think that that kind of, that level of surprise, like the fact that your character is just a disaster and is in a crisis right now, and you're trapped trying to negotiate a way out of this guy's like broken life and his kind of broken mind, is just wild. It's so cool. It's not like any other game I've played. I love it more each time I play it, and also am just laughing and laughing. Oh my God. Like I could go on and on and on with stories, but the writing is so funny, and that's the LucasArts thing to me is like...
Yeah, I think that's the key too, because it's very easy for... It would be very easy for a game like this to get lost in its own density and just kind of bury you mm-hmm. with psychobabble and dense history, and occasionally it does, but I think that sense of humor that it has all throughout really just makes it, like, elevates it to this level that it's unlike anything I played before. For example, there's a scene that always stood out to me while I was playing. You have this partner who you go around with, this guy named Kim Kutsuragi.
He's so great, too. What a
fantastic
character.
He's this stoic, straight-laced cop who...
It's soulful and cool.
By choosing all these great options, I mean, there's so many ways you can, like, get a rise out of him, or like mm-hmm. torture him, or like try to poke cracks in his facade of stoicism and like get him to actually have emotional reactions to you. But the best is when he, just being this super like hard-boiled stoic dude, actually does something funny. So like there's a scene in the game where you and him are like looking at a mural and talking about it and talking about what it means and the effects that it has, and you can choose to nod, and then he nods, and then you can choose to keep nodding and he'll keep nodding, and it can become this kind of standoff where you're both just nodding intensely to the point where it actually causes you physical pain from nodding so much, and you could potentially kill yourself like in the game,
like have a heart attack
by nodding
and
too much. Mm-hmm. So moments like that really stood out. And it's the type of game where I think Kirk and I have already, I won't spoil the specifics, but we've already compared notes and like had drastically different outcomes mm-hmm. for one quest. It's the type of game where you cannot really see everything in a single playthrough, A, because there's only so much you can actually do on any given day. And talking to people takes up time, so you can't feasibly do everything in one day. And then two, because you can choose so many different options for each of the quests and each of the dialogue conversations. It's one of those games, it's so interesting, especially also playing The Witcher 3. In The Witcher 3, you know, you guys know how when you're in dialogue with somebody, there'll be the white dialogue that's just like background and context and history. And then the yellow mm-hmm. dialogue is this advances the conversation. Most RPGs are structured like that, where like if you want to see everything before you move on, you can. But in Disco Elysium, every single dialogue option actually makes a difference. And like, if you're just going through picking, like trying to see everything, you can wind up pissing someone off so much that they'll never talk to you again, or like cost yourself
progress.
Man,
I found that just recently. I was talking with someone on the phone, and I had to replay the conversation because I died. Like my motivation just bottomed out, and my guy gave up on life, which happens sometimes more than you'd think. This guy's having a tough time. And I replayed it, and I found that when I didn't press on an uncomfortable topic, like when I figured out the subtext of what this woman was trying to tell me, which is basically that she was super creeped out by me, by things I didn't remember and didn't like me, I didn't push her on things, and then I had a way higher chance on a roll that I had to make at the end of the conversation, not because my stat was higher, but because she wasn't as angry or as like defensive. And mm-hmm. so it, which I realized that only, like, it was completely happening under the hood. The game didn't show me that. And I was like, that is so cool. There's so much stuff like that going on in this game. Uh-huh. I think one thing about this game, one thought I've had is that, and this is kind of an interesting comparison point to The Outer Worlds, which is the other game that I know you're playing, Jason, and that I'm also playing. What is cool about this game is that it is a mystery in that I don't know what happened. Like, I'm investigating a mystery. But the game is also a mystery. And it's been so long since I've played a game that felt like a mystery to me, where the act of playing it is like actually even figuring out how it works and what it is and what it's doing. And I'm so consistently mystified.
Outer Wilds kind of like that too. I feel like that game also.
Yeah, in a very different way. But yes, and that, of course, I was thinking that as I'm saying it, like that these are the two narrative games this year that have felt this way. But this is even more opaque because there are so many systems going on and there's this feeling of they're all there. The game is telling you, oh, this stat and that stat and this role and that role. But as you play, I'm constantly mystified and delighted by these little discoveries and these things I solve. And I think, that's why that happened. And the world itself is so mysterious and interesting. Mm-hmm. The backstory and the politics, the whole way this place works, it's like really a cool intellectual experience. Like the whole game is like a world inside your head. I really am so impressed by it and just adore it.
Yeah, you haven't even gotten up to my favorite part yet.
I can't wait.
I think generally happens on day 3. You'll know, and you'll
talk about it. Okay, I'm sure I'll be texting you.
So one thing I should say before we move on, even though I think this is one of my favorite games of the year and it's fantastic and everyone should go play it, it does kind of lose steam at the end and winds up railroading you in a way that is kind of is going to be unsatisfying to a lot of players, I think, and was unsatisfying for me for sure.
Do you know for sure that that's like just
every
like
time,
something that happens to everybody,
every
or was that type of your playthrough?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It happens every time. There's always one specific sequence of events that is always gonna happen in everybody's playthrough. I looked it up afterwards, and some stuff at the end didn't really resonate with me as much as the rest of the game did, which often happens in video games that they don't really stick the landing, except for Outer Wilds, which really stuck the language.
Stuck the landing. But it's hard for a game with that much choice to stick the landing because
that's a thing. Jeez. That's the thing, yeah. And a lot of games do it by just like presenting a variety of possible endings that only take place after the credits or like montages at the end.
It's
super tough
method
to pull that off. But the other thing is, and Kirk, I'm curious to see if this occurs to you or if you have this experience also, is like towards the end when you have fewer and fewer options, and in order to advance the plot, sometimes you have to like get past certain roles and get past certain checks. I found myself going into my inventory, going through all of the items that I had that like increase certain stats, because you can equip dozens of different things that like boost different stats, and then equipping them before I was about to do a stat roll, which was not fun, but I felt like I had to do it in order to like make the game better for myself.
I feel like that's really built into the game. I like read the PC Gamer tips, and they said that I've been saving my level ups for when I need a stat, because you can just save your level up points. Which like, so there's some there's like metagaming that you
that's
can
too
do.
Gamey. That's like
right.
Too.
I like mostly don't.
I feel like
but
that's
then,
not as fun.
But there are times where if I build it wrong, like having more volition, which gives me more motivation. For a while, I just had one. So literally any time I would take a motivation hit, I would just get a game over. And then it took me a while to realize, I need to just level up that stat. And then I get 2 points and I have a buffer. So stuff like that, it's been useful to save them a little bit. But yeah, I'm not surprised that the metagaming stuff gets in the way of how organic it all feels when you're not thinking about that stuff. And it, you know, I could see it being a serious challenge to make the whole game work that way. But I'm still excited to finish it.
Yes. Kirk, the other game you have here is Outer Worlds. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I've been playing this game some, and I see you've been playing it, so that's me and you. Okay. Yep. Maddie, do you think you're going to play Outer Worlds at some point?
I'd like to play Outer Worlds in Disco Elysium, but I'm having like a crisis right now where I'm in the middle of too many games, but we can get to me in a second.
So I'm having a similar problem, especially because, like we mentioned last week, we're playing Death Stranding to talk about it, and so now between Outer Worlds, Disco Elysium, Death Stranding, and the fact that Luigi's Mansion comes out tomorrow, and I'm so excited for that game, or we're recording this Wednesday, so it'll be out when everyone's listening to this, I'm like, okay, I've been having so much success this whole year by playing one game at a time. I've been loving it. It's been the best way to play video games, and I'm really trying to stick to it, but I've been bouncing back and forth, at least between Disco Elysium and Outer Worlds. And
This is, of course, the Obsidian game, not the Outer Wilds.
Right, Outer not Worlds, Outer Wilds.
The Obsidian
I don't really
RPG
make that mistake. I know people do, but I for some reason I'm able to... I get words mixed up a lot, actually, the older I get, but I don't mix up Worlds and Wilds for whatever reason.
Well, we'll see how you do when you talk about the game, and we will call you out.
Yeah,
if you
all right,
up.
Let me know if I screw it up.
Yeah, you just set your standards really
high. Yeah, you're
high.
Like, you're never going to screw it up, so go ahead.
I thought I'd make this segment more exciting for listeners. They can listen for when I have a senior moment. Okay, so Outer Worlds. Yeah, this game is like both good and weirdly disappointing to me. I'm struggling with it a little bit, despite the fact that I've played a lot of it and find it very pleasant and pleasurable to play. And some of that is in contrast to Disco Elysium specifically. It's one of those times where the context in which I'm playing a game, like playing one game and comparing it to another one, has led me to have a kind of interesting and distinct take on it that I might not have had if I just sort of played Outer Worlds as a person. And I'm sure that's not that useful to everybody listening if they just want to know if the game is good. Like, it's a good game. It's totally good. But it does give me that perspective on it anyways. I read a good article at PC Gamer. We can link it. Maybe I'll drop a link in show notes. I think it was at PC Gamer, and it was about... it was about that, actually, specifically about the struggling with Outer Worlds, because Disco Elysium is so kind of similar and yet different. Okay, so let me try to figure out how to articulate it. Outer Worlds is this, let me tell people what it is, I guess. It's an Obsidian game. It's basically Fallout New Vegas in space, but it's also Fallout New Vegas with a lot of the crustiness removed and the kind of weird Bethesda-iness, both for good and for ill in some ways. Like, it's very much more polished. They use Unreal Engine to make it. It looks a lot better. It's like a very nice looking game. It plays well. I haven't run into any bugs. I know there are some, but I haven't run into any. It's like the combat is...
It feels more like Mass Effect than New Vegas.
It has a lot in common with Mass Effect. It's like a Mass Effect, Firefly, Fallout thing. Mm-hmm. There are certain things like slow-mo kills and the way the camera pulls in on someone during dialogue that are extremely Fallout feeling or Bethesda feeling. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the combat is actually kind of Borderlands-y. Like, it reminds me a little of the first Borderlands. It's like Unreal Engine, kind of boring enemies, but there's like stuff going on and it's sort of fun to just run around and shoot people. It's a hell of a lot more fun than shooting has ever been in a Fallout game. Like, they're not even in this. It's a shooter. Like, it feels like an actual first-person shooter. So... yet, at the same time, the game is very streamlined. It doesn't have all the weird cruft of a Bethesda game, like all of the physical objects you can move around. And like, you know, like when you loot, this is a good example, when you loot someone for armor, they're lying there and you take their armor. It doesn't take the armor off of their model in the world the way that it does in a Bethesda game, because Bethesda games are like so simulated. Everyone's wearing clothes that they have equipped. Like, it's just an item on them and their body stays the same. So it feels just a little more
that
like
seems
actually
more like a budget thing than anything.
I don't
just
know.
Just it's a lower budget game.
I don't know about that. Like, I think it's all just been very streamlined and simplified. There's like leveling up is so much more simplified. The way that you level up now is it's really ingenious. Is you have like five categories, like large categories that contain three skills. So you'll have like your stealth area, and stealth is like lockpicking, sneaking, and hacking. And for the first half of your build, you just level up that, and they all three level up at the same time. So you're not forced to consider, oh my god, I don't know, do I want like this one really specific skill or that one? You just choose, oh, I want a stealth build, like I want a dialogue build. And then halfway through at 50, you pick individual skills to take to the really high levels, which is really smart. Like, I've never seen a game do that before. There's a lot of clever, streamlined stuff like that that makes this game really accessible. But it also makes it feel a little bit sterile, or like a little overly streamlined. Sometimes I'm playing it, I'm just like, this is such a smooth experience, but it also just all feels a little bit inevitable to me, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is because I'm playing Disco Elysium, which is this really mysterious game that's so thick and weird and twisting, and I'm going in all these cool directions and all this unexpected stuff is happening. To play a game that's so... I just know what's coming next. I know I'm going to get the next level up of the gun. I know I'm going to be able to talk my way through this conversation because my persuade skill is at 40. Like, everything just feels much more predictable. Yeah. And I think I could see that being really great for a lot of people. And like I said, I've played a lot of the game. I mean, it's a really pleasant thing to just chill out and play. It just doesn't quite have that oddness, and not even just of Disco Elysium, but even of a Fallout, like Fallout 3 or Fallout New Vegas, that kind of the feeling of simulation, the feeling of like just strangeness going on isn't there. It's very polished and like very well made. So that's...
It's funny. The last Obsidian game was Pillars 2, which, as I mentioned before, came out not too long after Divinity Original Sin 2, which kind of ruined that for that. And now it's funny that the next Obsidian game is also being ruined for you by another RPG that just
ruined.
Came out.
And ruined isn't the right word. They're very different.
Nope,
and
it's ruined. More that, it's terrible.
Right? It's more that I'm finding myself noticing that aspect of the experience more and feeling a little bit like hard to just totally get into it because I'm like, I don't know. I kind of know where this is going.
Well, I think one of the problems, and correct me if you disagree, but I think one of the problems is that a game like Disco Elysium has this mystery that keeps you hooked the entire time and makes you want to keep playing even if you might get to a hiccup or an obstacle or something you're bored with or something like that, whereas Outer Worlds doesn't really have that. It has really good writing and really funny stuff and some really interesting, like, well-acted, well-performed characters, but it doesn't really have that strong, compelling villain who is torturing you the whole time and who you really want to go take down, or it doesn't have that narrative hook of like a big mystery that you're trying to solve. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, you're here on this planet and now you have to go to a bunch of other planets and try to figure out what you want to do next.
It's partly that, I think. Like, the world building is a little hollow. Like, it's very, very cynical. The game takes place in this corporate colony, or like a collection of planets and moons, and it's all owned by corporations, and everything is like a corporate dystopia, and you just kind of show up and you're an outsider.
I, for one, cannot imagine a corporate dystopia.
Yeah. Well, really, it's funny to be playing both this game and Disco Elysium, at the same time, because both games are about like labor
systems
and union disputes. I mean, Disco Elysium is specifically set in the backdrop of an intense and violent union labor dispute that's happening. So it is all cuts a little close to the bone. But I find that I'm having a hard time finding a purchase because the game doesn't feel like it's coming from anywhere. It's like everyone is kind of a clown. Everyone is a part of this really shitty system. This is in Outer Worlds. And it's all very, I don't know, like it's kind of a playground. It feels a little bit like going to the video game mall or like to an amusement park. It just has that kind of feeling. Some of that is actually that this game also really feels like BioShock to me. Like there are just things about it, about the UX and the UI, the way that you pick up items. There's a sort of BioShocky feeling to it, which is kind of nice. Like, I like how BioShock games feel. They have this kind of bubbly, tactile quality to them, and I find that in Outer Worlds as well. But the world is not really pulling me in, definitely not in the way that Disco Elysium is, but also just not in the way that like a good video game world does. I agree with what you said. Like, there's good writing, it's well put together, but there's not something missing to the world. Isn't even just an overarching mystery or villain. It's just like there's a hollowness to everything that I'm finding mixes with the gameplay, though, because the gameplay is a big part of it. It's the fact that I have like an assault rifle Mark II and I know that it does this certain amount of damage and that I can like take it to a workbench and tinker and make it more powerful, and then I'll go into like combat against slightly harder enemies and I can just look at all of that and I'm like, all right. And then I look at my journal and it's just like, go kill the marauders here. Go have a conversation with this person. This guy wants you to get his research, but are you going to get it or are you going to give it to somebody else? There's just a feeling of, okay. And it makes me feel jaded. Like, I think I probably sound jaded. Some people are like, dude, shut up. It's a good video game. Why are you complaining about this? And
but
I'm not even exactly
before.
Like
no,
I said.
No, I hear you.
It's pleasant. But, well, just to finish that thought, there is a feeling of inevitability to it all that is then exacerbated by the way the world is this kind of slave corporate world that everybody is trapped in. And I think that there is a mechanical dissonance there in that the game is kind of at least asking you to ask all these questions about like corporate incentivized worlds where everyone is forced to like meet quotas and get to the new level and stuff, where the game itself is like so kind of conservative in that way and like really married to all of those incentivized game structures. And then I play it and I feel a little bit like each time I level up, oh man, like I level up and it plays this wonderful music that makes me feel so heroic. But that music also is the music that will play in 15 years when we're all like Amazon employees in like the Amazon corporate United States of America. Every time we like meet our quota for the day, that same music is going to play. And like, I'm more and more aware of that as I play it. And then one last comparison to put it against Disco Elysium, to play a game that is so joyfully and willfully willing to like explore the dynamics of like capitalism and that entire structure of like labor and management the way that Disco Elysium does, I'm like, well, this is like on the level. This is the conversation I want a game to be having. And Outer Worlds, it just feels much more sort of willfully just simplistic for the sake of just letting it kind of be so you can just have a place to play around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it also doesn't help that the game is really easy. There aren't.
I'm playing on hard. It definitely is better on hard.
Oh, it's better on hard. Okay,
yeah, I recommend it. I saw that tip everywhere. People were like, don't play on normal. It's super, super easy. And so
I mean, one of the great
on
things about Disco Elysium is that there is no combat. And like, so there's no filler. There's no like goblins right. in the street that you have to kill to get to the next cutscene or whatever. There's just nothing boring about the game, which is really, really rare and cool mm-hmm. and interesting. And man, it's so cool to have indie games that are just like taking these crazy experiments and doing yeah. really fascinating
I mean, there's
things.
There's only nothing boring if you like to read. I feel like the reason why the game can take the risks that it's taking is because it's almost entirely text-based. Like I mm-hmm. can't really see how a game like Outer Worlds could do that in the same way. Like there's going to be some more binary choices.
No. I'm not saying Outer Worlds should do that. I'm just saying it's an interesting.
I mean, it's too bad it can't.
Element. Well, it's just an interesting element of Disco Elysium that there is no combat. Right. I mean, I imagine there are definitely, like, I would love to see a AAA video game that tries to have no combat in it whatsoever. Mm. Although,
you mean Outer Wilds? No, it's not a AAA game. Just kidding.
No. And that is absolutely true, though, Maddie, that like because, you know, there is voice acting in Disco Elysium, but most conversations start with voice acting. And then as it gets thicker and thicker, they go to text because, yeah, they couldn't be doing the amount of, especially the amount of introspection and the way that you're interacting with things, like without all yeah. that text. And there
yeah.
is
but
this
the,
like...
The point is yeah. the interesting, you're always making interesting decisions as opposed to something like Outer Worlds where you're fighting a bunch of robots and there's nothing interesting about it. The interesting stuff comes afterwards, so there's these moments of like dullness between the interesting stuff, and it doesn't feel as good as the bar is set so high by Destiny's shooting that like even the boring shooting in Destiny is always going to be fun as opposed to Outer Worlds, which is just fine. Anyway, we've been going on long enough. Maddie, anything that you wanted to talk about that you're
sure.
playing?
I'll just say I'm having a very game journalist unrelatable problem for the past few weeks where I've like started playing a bunch of games in part for work, and like I've talked about them on this show, obviously mentioned I have Death Stranding, but I also have been playing Borderlands 3, and I've even started playing Destiny in part because I was
very
wanted
exciting.
To talk about it on this show. But as a result of that, I've just like been in the middle of playing a bunch of games, mm-hmm. can't remember what the controls are for any of the games, am having like a deeply unsatisfying experience every time I play each of them, and the past week has sucked for a lot of reasons. But I was thinking to myself on more than a few days the past week, like if work were not an object and I could play whatever I wanted, like what would the game be? And the answer was that I really just want to finish Fire Emblem. So I've just been doing that in my free time. I'm past nice. The time skip. I don't know if I'm ever going to actually play the game all three times and see every possible ending. I don't think it's going to freaking happen. And I'm moving on with my life, but it has been super nice to lie down and stare at my Switch and just read oodles of text in Fire Emblem. And it's like a mega easy game. It's simple.
It gets very easy by that point. Yeah.
You do not really have to use your brain at all to play that game. And that is all I wanted to do. So that's what I spent my free time doing this week.
Nice.
Is that
I think beautiful. That I've found that I think in the second half, I've mentioned this maybe, it gets a little harder toward the end, but mm-hmm. mostly, yeah, it's not that challenging. And it moves faster.
I'm like very over leveled as well because I've played so many auxiliary battles, like just mm-hmm. for the heck of it, just mindlessly, that I'm like wildly over leveled so I can just plow through the story mm-hmm. and like demolish everyone in a way that is very satisfying and like barely a game.
Just...
Who am I to say what a video game is or isn't?
Right.
But the way that I'm clicking through Fire Emblem, there's not that much brain power involved on my part, but it's really hitting the spot. So
nice,
whatever.
Nice.
It's a way to play a game.
The main character in that game is just ridiculous. It's just the
you mean
ultimate
Violet?
Power
like power wise. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So you become basically a god.
Why don't we take a little bit of a break and then we can talk about some video game news, shall we? And And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's talk about some news in the world of video games and distract ourselves from all the other horrible stuff that's happening. First of all, BlizzCon. So I know you guys talked about all this craziness with China and Hong Kong and Blizzard. Mm-hmm. While I was gone, I got to watch that stuff from afar. But now the BlizzCon is coming up. It feels like we're getting to a head. So what's interesting about this BlizzCon is that it had always been planned as like the big one. Like last year's BlizzCon.
The redemption for them.
Yeah, you guys remember last year's BlizzCon. Everyone was hoping for like a Diablo 4 teaser of some sort, but instead they showed Diablo Immortal, which crushed a lot of fans' hopes and made people really angry for legitimate and illegitimate reasons. Certainly led to a lot of whining for one reason or another. But Blizzard's plan was always, you know what, like we don't have any games coming out in 2019, but we do have some games that we can finally show and let people play at BlizzCon 2019. So their plan was always like Diablo 4, Overwatch 2, and Diablo 2 remastered, among other things, like a new World of Warcraft expansion, and I'm sure other stuff, maybe even stuff I don't know about. I don't know. Definitely a mobile game or two as well. But the plan was like, we're going to blow people away with these announcements. And when people see Diablo 4, it's true, they're probably going to flip. But what nobody could have anticipated was all this Hong Kong drama, which we don't have to relitigate, but the short version is they suspended a Hearthstone streamer for shouting Liberate Hong Kong on a stream. They later walked back the suspension and like returned his prize money, which they had taken away, but still a suspension. So the big question is, and I'm curious to hear what you guys think, is that going to be the storyline of this BlizzCon, or will Diablo 4 and Overwatch 2 just like be so hypey and exciting and just like be so like overwhelming for fans that everybody just forgets about Hong Kong and barely even mentions it? Maddie, what do you think is going to happen?
I think it's going to be one of these epic Twitter wars where if you talk about Overwatch 2 and you express excitement about it, a ton of people are going to be really mad at you. But also there's going to be a lot of people who are really mad that they can't talk about like Diablo or Overwatch. And it's just going to be like neck and neck, like your whole Twitter timeline just pissed at each other. And no matter what you say, it's going to be wrong. And I'm going to be quietly reading it all and just taking it in, not tweeting a dang thing during it all. And I think the Twitch chat... I don't tweet that much in general, honestly, and I recommend it as a lifestyle choice. But I also think the Twitch chat is going to be very similar to that. I think public response is going to be really divided between people wanting to be very excited about these games that are anticipated and updates to games that they're anticipating, but also feeling guilty and also feeling angry about the decisions that Blizzard has made. And I think that is going to color the entire event and be every conversation that is had. Could be wrong. Yeah. Might just be everybody being excited about Overwatch or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder. So Blizzard has a couple of events that are going to have like fan Q&As. They do pre-screen questions, but they always did that. And last year, the Diablo, the guy who said like, is this an April Fool's joke or something, got through regardless. So it's very easy to be like, to tell them you're going to ask a question.
Say one question. Yeah.
The big question is, and I've talked to some Blizzard folks about this, and they seem pretty relaxed and like not really worried, because I think everybody knows that they're about to just like show everything they have and be like, look at all this shit we have like in the pipeline for the next couple of years, and they think that'll blow people away, which I'm sure it will. Like, I'm sure Diablo 4 is gonna be awesome and like look awesome, and Overwatch 2 I'm sure is gonna be really exciting for Overwatch players. But anyway, I think that it'll be interesting to see if there's like one meme, one viral moment that winds up dominating the conversation the way there was last year. And I think that is the crux of it. Like, is it going to be the type of thing where people are just like scoffing on Twitter, like you said, and just like going and like attacking people who get hyped on Twitter, or like spamming Twitch with Free Hong Kong, that sort of thing? But then everyone is really just like blown away by the games that they don't really pay attention to that. Or is there going to be some lasting message or image that sticks with us the way that red shirt guy stuck with us last year? And that is what I'm really curious to see. Like, if someone gets up on stage, if there's like protesters make it into the keynote and like they take the stage or something like that, or someone gets up and asks a question that, in a way that makes it go viral, those will be the lasting images of this BlizzCon. So I am very curious to see if that happens. Kirk, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, pretty much that. I think that this is a unique, or probably fairly, you can't be fairly unique. This seems like a unique chance for a major, one of these major corporations like Apple, like the NBA, who have recently been in the news about, you know, censoring American people talking about Hong Kong and China. It's like a rare public venue for one of those organizations where something like this could even happen because it's so centralized. It all happens at once. There's a big live stream. There's a big stage. So there's like a whole, you know, everything is focused on this one point. And as a result of that, if it's going to happen anywhere, we're going to see this, you know, manifest itself somehow in the real world. And it'll be more than just people writing articles and like complaining online. It'll be a real thing. You know, protesters outside. Protests are like a big way that this kind of thing becomes real. And I'm definitely going to be following her along. I mean, I want to know what's going to happen. I'm curious because so many times we've seen people be upset about something that a company has done. But when the company does the thing that they do that everyone loves them for extremely well, in this case, Blizzard makes really good video games that people love. When they announce new games, I mean, that's their lane. That's the thing they do. And when people get, when people see that, of course, people get really excited because that's exciting. Like Diablo 4,
oh my gosh.
And there
hasn't been a new Blizzard game in a very long time.
Right. Yeah. So it's understandable that people would get excited. And in the past, that totally happens where people are mad about a thing, but then a really sensational announcement.
Yeah.
And they don't, and it's not like they forget about it, right? Like people will remember and they'll be like, I'm still troubled by the thing, but damn if that Overwatch 2 trailer wasn't hot as hell. And I could see that happening, but this maybe could be different. And because it's happening at this event and the timing is what it is and all eyes are kind of focused on this one place, maybe it'll be different. I'm certainly curious to see.
Have either of you ever been to BlizzCon, like to cover it or just otherwise?
No.
It's okay. In Anaheim.
So I'm the only one who's been. I covered it for Compete the first year that I worked here. And what really struck me about it in comparison to stuff like E3, where like, you know, you're in the room with a bunch of other reporters and also like now E3 has fans as well, is that Blizzard, it's fans, but it's fans of a corporation. And that gives those keynotes a really different, weird vibe. Mm-hmm. Like the kinds of things that people cheer for. And like the way that people like wear Blizzard t-shirts and they don't work at Blizzard, they're there to support Blizzard the company, and their identity as is not just gamers but Blizzard fans at that con was very striking to me. And it makes perfect sense. I'm not saying it's strange at all, but there's a lot of people who've built up an identity around Blizzard, and that's part of why I think this is going to be so strange and interesting, because it's not the same as like an E3 announcement or something like that where there's a whole lot of different kinds of people there who are interested in it for different reasons. This is like hardcore Blizzard fans and reporters who've just been covering Blizzard, and that's their career is covering Blizzard. And that's like wild to me that this company has made a decision that's so unpopular and that now they have to do BlizzCon, like to their greatest fans. But a lot of those fans are really pissed at them. So yeah, I don't know. I think the tension in the room is going to be really interesting. And I'm psyched to hear from Nathan and Heather, who are going to be there, about what that tension is like. Because when I was there, I remember like the things people cheered for. I was like, people are cheering for like a staffer they know. And like they cheer for Blizzard in a way that like is not the same as other conventions. So that'll be really interesting to see for sure.
So one other thing before we move on is that something that I've been covering for a while now is Activision's continuing exertion of influence over Blizzard, and the way that they've installed a lot of people who have kind of taken top positions, and the way that they are kind of impacting the way that Blizzard does business in a way they never have before. And I think because of that, among other reasons, a lot of veteran Blizzard staff have left over the past year. We've seen not just the big names, like people like Mike Morhaime, the CEO, is the biggest one, people like Chris Metzen and others, Frank Pierce and some of the other original founders. But also, I just reported this week that a couple of months ago, Dustin Browder and Eric Dodds and Jason Chase, who are all pretty top-level veteran people on Hearthstone and StarCraft, all left the company. It's mainly because their projects that they were working on were canceled. Dustin Browder, for example, was directing that StarCraft first-person shooter that was canceled a few months ago. But it's something to keep an eye on, and I think that the results of like a company's culture eroding and a company's talent leaving is not something that is instantly I see you laughing there, Kirk. It's not something that is instantly like easy to see.
No, really? Continue.
Well,
No, a company the this thought. Big, this is all very
a huge company. I agree.
And a big
that it's
company,
not always
and a company with thousands of people, and especially a company that makes video games. But it will be really interesting to just keep watching Blizzard over the coming years and to see if, like, if they wind up on a schedule of no longer going 3 years or 4 years without a release anymore, because that's not Activision. That's not how Activision does business. Activision is a company that does Call of Duty every year without fail, no matter what, and I can see them trying to turn Blizzard into more of that type of company where they're producing a lot more, maybe grinding people into the ground as a result, or maybe chasing off talented developers and bringing in more people who would just want to work at Blizzard because of the appeal of working at Blizzard because of the name Blizzard. As one, it's there has been different people there. Obviously, it's such a big company that it's impossible to say, like, morale is bad across Blizzard, but there's definitely some trepidation across some of the people that I've spoken to at Blizzard about the company over the past year, and it will be something to watch. Maybe we won't see the results of that at this BlizzCon, because I actually think this BlizzCon is going to be pretty exciting for a lot of people, but it's worth keeping an eye on and watching, and I'll continue reporting on that sort of thing. Anyway, let's move on to a couple more news stories. First of all, man, Ghost Recon Breakpoint. Apparently that game is so bad that Ubisoft had to acknowledge in an earnings call that it's bad. And also Ubisoft was just like, hey, we're delaying all these games. And apparently what I've heard from people at Ubisoft, because I talked to a couple of people since this big announcement that they had last week, which was that they delayed Gods and Monsters, Watch Dogs, and Rainbow Six Quarantine, all of which were planned for like this fiscal year, so before March, are now all pushed back. Conversations I had with people are like, now Ubisoft is changing their mentality big time. Now it's all about, like, you have to pitch your game as being super unique, having some unique aspect to it, and it all sounds really wild. It's this really crazy atmosphere. Kirk, you played Ghost Recon, right? I think that it's one of those games that just was trying to be everything, right? It had all these RPG elements that people didn't like.
Yeah, I didn't play it. We talked to Steven about it a little bit, but I haven't played it.
Okay,
but
the
understanding of that game, though, is fairly clear, is that this game is like a third-person tactical Tom Clancy shooter with loot elements, and it came out a few months after The Division 2, which apparently also, they said, didn't do as well as they wanted it to. So it was very, just immediately from the get-go, this is not, and not even mentioning the game had a lot of problems and technical polish issues and other things.
Right.
But just as a concept, like, it completely makes sense that they would change their approach to say you have to have an explanation for why your game is unique, because they just ran into this where they released a game that, on top of another game that already hadn't done well. And both of those games were so almost totally indistinguishable from one another that nobody got excited about, especially about the second one, but I sense people weren't even that excited about The Division 2. And so that, it doesn't really surprise me, but all the delays and everything, it seems like an unusually large impact from a game kind of bombing the way that it sounds like that game.
Well,
did.
I think part of it is, and it's like, if this was EA, I wonder what they would have done, because I think Ubisoft is the rare company that seems to have actual, like, investment in creative in a way that they just, like, seem to really care about quality, and have proven that in a lot of ways over the years, despite some of their games feeling very samey. Just a little bit of inside info. Gods and Monsters is one of those games that I had heard people were, like, really worried about its schedule, because that's the same team or a chunk of the team that made Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which came out in fall of 2018. So that would have been a year and a half, I believe.
It was always weird, right? I remember when it was at
E3. I feel like we talked about this on the show.
Well, I remember hearing then it was codenamed Orpheus, and I remember people saying to me, like, this game Orpheus is, like, it was greenlit because they need something for this fiscal year, but it's going to be kind of a mess, and who knows what's going to happen. So that is really interesting. Watch Dogs, that I believe was supposed to be released originally planned for, like, fall of this year. Then it was delayed to March to stay within the fiscal year but give them as much time as possible, and now it's been delayed even further. I think the main reason for that is just their main hook is so ambitious. Their main system of, like, you can control any character in the game is so wild and ambitious that I imagine it's causing all sorts of technical problems and challenges that they have to deal with. And I'm hopeful that they deal with those problems, because that game seems really cool and fascinating. And then Rainbow Six Quarantine, I think, is also another game that was just kind of greenlit not very long ago, because that is the game that was codenamed Pioneer after the space game Pioneer, even though it has nothing to do with the space game Pioneer. I'm a little bit confused about the sequence of events there. That was the canceled game that was teased in Watch Dogs 2.
Right,
but anyway,
right,
it's a good thing. It's just like a generally good thing that all these games are getting delays. Same with The Last of Us 2, which got a delay from February to May. It's never a bad thing for a game when a game is delayed. Although I should also add that it can often be a bad thing for the team when a game is delayed, because if you are at a company full of workaholics, such as, just pulling this from thin air, Naughty Dog, and you are crunching your ass off to try to get The Last of Us 2 out the door, and everyone and management is like, hey guys, we're delaying the game for 3 months. That doesn't suddenly mean that like you can schedule your vacations and take weekends off and stuff for the next 3 months. It means like we're continuing, keep up the momentum, guys. Gotta full steam ahead. Keep pushing, guys. We appreciate all your hard work, guys. That good for the game, maybe not so good for the workers, but delays everywhere.
Pretty much.
And then one more thing, Fallout 76, which I think I predicted that there would be headlines being like, Fallout 76 is good now, but alas,
oh, yeah, that's
instead,
right, that was. Oh, I
feel like
forgot
that
about
did
that
happen
prediction.
For a little bit. Like,
what
there were some headlines
prediction.
That were kind of like that, but whatever.
Fallout 76, Bethesda announced last week, and not only it was like a simultaneous announcement and launch. Fallout First, which is this monthly premium subscription that you pay to get a bunch of stuff, including like private servers, among other things, and unlimited stash and
heavy
other,
scare
other
quotes
stuff.
On private servers. But I know you're going to get to that.
So the thing I was going to bring up actually, and then you can talk about your scare quotes on private servers. The thing I was going to bring up is Bethesda is such an interesting company. So they just delayed Doom Eternal out of the fall also. Here's my theory, and this is not based on inside info. I should put the caveat there. This is just entirely me speculating, right? My theory is that ZeniMax has been looking to get bought for a long time. They're a private company, and I think they've been looking to get purchased by somebody. My theory is that this is like them trying to pump up revenue as much as possible in preparation for an acquisition, and being like, Elder Scrolls Online makes a ton of money with their premium subscription, so maybe we can do the same with Fallout 76 and let's get this acquisition train moving, especially in the wake of a lot of their games not performing very well, like Prey and Dishonored 2 and Rage 2, and I can't think of many hits they've had in recent years. So yeah, that's my theory, is they want to get bought. So they're like pump and dump, which is something that some of us might find very familiar, is a company looking to just like
another
company.
Never heard
that
of
ever
that
happening.
Kind of thing.
Cranking out short-term profits. Kirk, what were you going to say about private servers?
Oh, just that the private servers don't really work, apparently, the way they were supposed to. Like, people who you're friends with can still walk in, and a lot of people are friends with a lot of people. So people just randomly be turning up in your little private server, and you'll be like, why? And then, because it doesn't work. And also, I think you get, like, you get a storage crate that was erasing people's stuff that they were putting in it. So basically, the stuff that people were paying for that you get in the game, if you pay $100 a year for this service or whatever the monthly rate is, it doesn't even work, which is classic. I saw a comment, I think Luke Plunkett, who has been, the Kotaku writer Luke Plunkett has been a regular kind of on the beat of Fallout 76's just ongoing catastrophe. And some comment just basically said, I think that this game is legitimately cursed. And I've never seen a cursed video game before, but I just get that feeling. Because if you just go from the beginning, it's just failure after failure after failure. Like, everything has gone wrong. And that, I think that just that happening the same week that Obsidian releases The Outer Worlds, which for all of my niggling, weird narrative and analytical gripes or whatever, is a fantastic game that's super fun and basically takes the Fallout thing and does it right, like does it just very, very well. Clearly, they just had the time they needed when they didn't have the time to make New Vegas. They were able to realize so many ambitions with it. And the same week, Fallout 76, this like comically beleaguered online game, gets this shitty monthly service that breaks things if you pay for it. And so, you know, it's a very, very appropriate.
Not only that, but I tweeted this the other day, but in case you guys didn't see, The Outer Worlds is on Xbox Game Pass, which is their Netflix service. Xbox Game Pass is $9.99 a month, $10 a month. Fallout First is $13 a month. So for less than Fallout First, you can actually get The Outer Worlds and 100 other games.
Isn't your first month like a dollar too, I think,
for the Xbox Game Pass? Yeah, if you sign up just for a month, you get it for a dollar. So The Outer Worlds, but you could also get Fallout New Vegas, and I believe Fallout 3 and 4 are on there too. So you can get as many Fallout games as you want.
Cool. A lot of good gaming.
Good deal.
Or, you know, you could also get a private server that doesn't work and a crate that eats your gear.
Yes.
You could have that.
I think
well.
I'm going to go with that. That sounds really good.
I made a good pitch for it.
Can't decide. It's sort of like when you buy a media company and you can't decide whether to let them keep doing what they're really good at and
keep making
money for you, or just fuck with their livelihoods. And
right. You could like
totally
you could totally fuck things up and ruin everything. I mean, decisions, right? It's tough.
Like,
it's
what
a
would
tough,
you
it's
want to
a,
do? Yeah.
It's always a tough call. Yeah.
Anyway, why don't we take another break and then we can get into some off-topic stuff. And we are back once again. Maddie, what are you listening to, watching, reading, whatever? Tell me.
I have completed watching the second season of Mindhunter, which, all Kirk, right. You also finished watching it, right?
I did. It was my off-topic a little while back.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just going to say I think it's pretty good. I also think that you can completely skip the first season of this show, which is not that great. It's fine. Mm-hmm. But I think the second season is a lot stronger. I do wish it were even better. I feel like there's a version of the show. So it's kind of based on a nonfiction book about the people who figured out the term serial killer and like psychologically investigated serial killers and you know, worked for the government in order to do so and with the cops and got the funding to do that. And so it's like, you know, early days of discovering what serial killers are and how they operate. That's basically what the show's about. And it's interesting. And I just want it to be so much better than it is. But I feel like this is one of those rare cases where the second season of a Netflix show is actually better than the first. And I can't think of another time that I've seen that happen.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, you know what? This is a situation where the show like had to get its feet wet in the first season, took a really long time to introduce the characters that I thought were interesting. In the second season, they introduce a couple new characters who I really like. There's finally some characters of color on what was previously a very white and very like insulated show that was mostly just about like white killers and white people. And now the show is about like a lot of other different kinds of people that I frankly find a lot more interesting. So yeah, I guess I'm saying, if you had second thoughts about the show and you want to just skip the first season, maybe you started it and didn't want to. Jason, I know that applies to you. You might like the second season.
Actually, I stopped after the pilot because it was so boring.
Yeah. I can't really blame you. It doesn't start strong.
I like Anna Torv just as an actress. I think she's just really grown on me since Fringe. I think she's cool. And I don't know, her characters are always interesting and I like her voice. She just has a nice, like an interesting presence. And I think it's cool that they focused more on her character in season two. I thought that you know, it was kind of similar to how in season one there was a part of the story was about one of the three main characters' like personal life more than the other two. And then on this season, I thought, I mean, I guess it also got into what's his name, the guy and his son. So it was
which
maybe kind of
I
the two
was
of them.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I thought all the B plots in the second season were
exactly.
more interesting.
Like they were all more interesting, and I liked her. I just think she's an interesting character because she's kind of hard to read, and I just find that interesting because I'm like, I want to know more about you. And so it was cool. That they
basically, they
her.
Just kind of get away from Jonathan Groff, and, like,
right?
Stop
right.
letting his
which is
weird
fine.
Character yeah. do stuff, and that was the character right. you didn't like, Jason. So anyway,
I am almost done with the Netflix anime Carol and Tuesday, which I have been watching probably to the surprise of no one who knows what Carol and Tuesday is, only because I'm such a staunch advocate of Kids on the Slope, which is kind of the spiritual predecessor of this show. So this is another show directed by Shinichiro Watanabe, the creator of Cowboy Bebop and the director of Kids on the Slope. It's another musical anime, like it's a music anime. It's about two young women who live on Mars. Mars is now fully terraformed, so it's kind of sci-fi, so it's kind of in the future. And they're both musicians, and they meet and immediately form this beautiful songwriting partnership. And then they write songs together, and then they go on to, you know, whatever. They're like on a competition show now where they're playing against other bands. And it's great. It's really fun. I recommend it. I like it a lot. And what's striking to me about it more than anything, maybe unsurprisingly, is kind of like Kids on the Slope, which was the story of 60s boys in Japan playing jazz together and becoming friends. It It's really sweet and very gentle. It's a very kind of like a playful, kind of almost childish show sometimes in the way that it views the world. And so it can feel a little saccharine at times when there's no music going on. But the music is just done so well. I think that Watanabe just clearly really understands music and it loves it and is very good at depicting it. And the musical scenes are so great, partly because people will perform, all these other artists in the Martian pop music scene will get up on stage and they'll sing a song. And I was looking up who wrote the music, and it's this whole team of songwriters, so it's not clear to me who's written each song, but every song is good. Like, they all start out, it's like, it'll be a kind of catchy pop tune, and then it just is good. The melody is really good, it does really cool things, and I find myself really into the music. And the songs that they write together are really good, too. And it shows, Maddie, you'll appreciate this. You haven't seen this show, right?
No, not yet. I'd like
to. Oh, man. Yeah, you'd probably dig it. Or it's a fun show. But there's a scene in early on where they're writing together and they sit down and let me think. So Tuesday plays the guitar and Carol plays the keyboard and they both sing and they both write and they're playing and like Carol is kind of playing an idea on the piano and then you hear Tuesday kind of figuring it out and then she hums a little melody and then you hear the piano figure it out and it's really believable the way that it actually sounds like two people who both know how to play an instrument sitting there figuring out a song together. I've never heard anything like it in a show before. Like, it was so believable because it was just really well done and it totally drew me in, and then they come up with this idea and you hear them kind of develop it into a song, and then it's this really beautiful song that they perform is really good. So I've been finding that show to be just very pleasing, and the music
is great.
It feels
like a show that was just made for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as much as Kids on the Slope, which is like straight up just like jazz.
Yeah,
nerdery,
this one might be made for me. I'm gonna check
right?
it out.
It does have, yeah, it's great though. I like it, and it's like a really pleasant show to watch with good music. So that is, I do give it a recommendation.
So I have actually watched a lot of television in the past few weeks.
What? Yeah, shocked to hear that. That's so surprising.
Turns out when you have a baby. So one of the things about having a baby is if you are ever bottle feeding him and her, whether you're bottle feeding with formula or pumped breast milk, you have to use both hands because you basically have to support the baby's head with one hand and then feed in the bottle with the other hand. So that means you can't do anything except like watch something. So I couldn't play games while doing that, couldn't do much except watch things. And so we kind of, well, over the past 4 weeks, we've kind of always just had the TV going while we try to do other stuff. So we've wound up watching a lot of just like random shows that we don't pay 100% attention to, but they're just always on. So like we watched the entirety of 30 Rock in the past few weeks just because it was a good show to just like keep on in the background. We are rewatching Happy Endings, which is probably one of the best sitcoms ever made, by the way. You guys need to watch that show. But I don't want to talk about that stuff. I want to talk about a movie that I watched a couple of days ago, which is called El Camino, aka the Breaking Bad movie. Have you guys both seen Breaking Bad?
Yes.
Nope.
No, okay, Kirk, you have. Maddie, you haven't. Maddie, man, you should. You should get on that.
Nah, I'm good. I started it. Wasn't for me,
wasn't
but keep
for you.
Going.
Fair enough. So El Camino is set. So Breaking Bad is one of those shows that is so tightly plotted that like it had the perfect ending. It was this ending that just like tied everything together neatly and just put a bow on everything. There was no need to continue it. And just for some context, so after Breaking Bad, the series creators, a bunch of people involved with the show, wound up making Better Call Saul, which is this show based on a spinoff based on a character from Breaking Bad that I think is even better. And at first people were like, oh, why does this show exist? Does it really need to be there? But it wound up just like setting its own bar for quality and like reaching these incredible heights. Better Call Saul is one of my favorite shows. So I kind of felt like, oh, well, a movie that's set after Breaking Bad that tells the story of what happened to this guy, Jesse, who's one of the two main characters, Aaron Paul's character, that could seem like that seems unnecessary based on the ending of Breaking Bad, but like based on Better Call Saul's track record, I feel like it's got to be awesome. So we watched that the other day. It just came out and it was completely unnecessary. It was, yeah. We watched it and it was 2 hours and like basically nothing happens that you need to know about. Like, it kind of almost ends in the same place it began. It's just very unnecessary. Like, if you ask me if you should watch it, I would say, well, it's good, it's entertaining, it's captivating, it's like really incredible cinematography and writing, and everything you love that, or at least that Kirk loves about Breaking Bad is in this, but like, it's so unnecessary. It just did not need to exist in a way that Better Call Saul feels the exact opposite. Like, this Better Call Saul feels like this vital, like, like really, really well, incredible story that needed to be told, whereas El Camino does not. So kind of a letdown just after the expectations they've set for themselves. So yeah, just kind of like a you could watch it. It's good, but no need to, I would say. I've also been reading real quick Stephen King's new book, The Institute, and it is phenomenal.
That?
Oh,
nice.
Man. I mean, I'm a huge Stephen King fan, I should say, but so are you, Kirk. But yeah, it's really, really well done. One of his best in recent years. I haven't liked a lot of some of his stuff. He wrote this whole trilogy, like the Mr. Mercedes trilogy that I didn't love. But this,
You've read 1122, right? 1122, 63?
Oh, yeah, good
book.
That was one of my favorites, yes.
Nice. Oh, I'm glad to hear it's good.
Man, it's really good. You should get it. It's the short version is it's a story about this kid who is a super genius and is found to have psychic powers, like minor psychic powers. And one day he is taken from his home and brought to this institute that like they take these kids with psychic powers to and trap them in. And who is behind this institute? Why are they treating the kids like garbage in this institute? And that becomes the story. And it's really, really good. And
Stephen King anyway. He's like very good at writing kids. So that's
he's cool become such a master of his craft. Like there is these sequences. I'm not done with the book yet. I'm towards the end, but there's a sequence that I'm reading now that is just like alternating between these scenes of all the different characters that are doing things, and it's just zipping between them, and it feels like you're reading a movie and this incredible cinematic just like popping off the page. It's really, really just like inspirational as a writer, and he is just, man, on top of his game, like still firing on all cylinders.
Good to hear.
So that is it for me. I think, Kirk, why don't we get into your music pick of the week.
Sure, let's do it. So there's a new Strong Songs. It is Making Christmas from The Nightmare Before Christmas, which I'd been excited to talk about for a long time. I love The Nightmare Before Christmas. It's almost Halloween. It's perfect timing. So that was super fun and got me listening to a lot of Danny Elfman music. Danny Elfman, of course, is the composer of The Nightmare Before Christmas and sings the lead part. He sings
and
Jack
the
Skellington.
Theme, which you
and the Simpsons theme and the Batman theme and so many other great themes. One of my favorite composers ever. He was also, I think a lot of people probably know this, he was the lead singer of the new wave band Oingo Boingo in the 1980s. That was kind of before he was doing a lot of film scoring. And so I was going back and listening to a lot of that while I was making this episode. And the album Dead Man's Party, which came out in 1985, has that song. It has Weird Science on it. So it's like kind of the big Oingo Boingo album. But there's a song on it called Just Another Day. It's the opening track from the album that I've always really loved. And so I wanted to make that the music pick. So here is a clip of Just Another Day by Oingo Boingo, sung by Danny Elfman. This is from Dead Man's Party, which came out in 1985. When I step out the door, the jungle is alive. I do not trust my ears. I don't believe my eyes. I will not fall in love. Man, Danny Elfman can sing. That dude can do everything. His singing freaks me out in particular, but it's just like, cool, you're really good at like everything. You're like a fucking genius. Like, wow.
But can he dance? That's
can
the only thing
dance?
That really matters.
Man, the video for this song is worth watching.
Kirk, that's how I felt when I saw your friggin' new music thing. I was like, God damn it, you can play everything.
So thanks. The video for this song is good. It's like very 80s and very silly, and he's
I'll
making weird
out.
Faces. It's very
awesome.
Like weird 80s band stuff that
very
is
good.
Very enjoyable.
Good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Very enjoyable. All right. I think that is it for this week's episode. I am back. We are all back. Things are great. Things are rosy in Kotaku
it's
land.
All fine. Everything's totally fine.
Everything's totally fine. Just a reminder, just a refresher in case you missed the beginning of this episode, that if suddenly split screen stops appearing on your feed, just keep an eye out for us. Google one of our names. Yeah. Find our Twitter feeds. We will tell you where to go. But we are going to keep podcasting no matter what. We're going to keep up the show in some form or another. So do not stress if suddenly split screen disappears. We will still be around.
Also, everyone who's just voice supporter said they like the show. A lot of people were being really cool on Twitter yesterday saying they love split screen. Thanks to all of you. Like, it's really
that's
nice
awesome.
To hear from you guys.
Big
that's
thanks.
Really cool. It's awesome that people like our show at all. So thank you.
Okay. That is it. I will see you guys next week.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Maddie Myers, Kirk Hamilton, and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on most popular podcast services, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen and email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.